Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.com or .org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel for those of you who are particularly adventurous. I'm Jeffrey Bleich, former U.S. Ambassador to Australia, former special counsel to President Obama, and now CEO of Diplomatic Solutions at the Dentons Global Law Firm. And I'm your moderator for this program. And I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished guests, George Mitchell, the retired United States Senator, former U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, and co-author of a book, A Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations, and A Way Forward in the Middle East. And joining Senator Mitchell is Alon Sakar, former advisor to the U.S. Ambassador to Israel, as well as to Senator Mitchell, and co-author of A Path to Peace. Today, we'll be discussing how the Trump administration should handle Israel and Palestine, and Palestinian people going forward, and the new steps the United States and international community can take to encourage a peace agreement. But first, let me say a bit about our guests. George Mitchell, he knows how to bring peace to troubled regions. We could use you back in the Senate these days. It would take the entire program to recount his illustrious career, which has included everything from being a federal judge to majority leader of the United States Senate, chairman of the Walt Disney Company, being the man who brought peace to Ireland, who rid baseball of anabolic steroids, who received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and was knighted by the Queen. In short, he is the best thing to come out of Maine since lobster.
I got to remember to tell my former Senator Bill Cohen about that.
Alon Sakar is a local hero, currently practicing with Gibson Dunn here in San Francisco. He served as an advisor to U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Daniel Shapiro, in Tel Aviv from 2011 to 2012, and to President Obama's special envoys for Middle East peace, first Senator Mitchell, and then David Hale from 2009 to 2011. From 2006 to 2009, he served in the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs, focusing on the U.S. bilateral relationship with Israel and the Palestinians, as well as Arab-Israeli relations. So please welcome Senator George Mitchell and Alon Sakar.
Thank you.
Now, normally, when someone writes a book about a path forward, how to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you say to them, well, you know, it's that's ambitious. What makes you think you can do this when everyone else has failed for the past 50 years, 60 years? On the other hand, you brought peace to Northern Ireland. So it's a different conversation with you, Senator Mitchell. You've actually been through that sort of cynicism and skepticism and come out the other side with real success. So what motivated you to write this book at this time, and what do you see as the potential effect of it?
Well, first, let me thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for joining us here, for your very kind words. Our thanks to the Commonwealth Club for giving us the opportunity, first, the pleasure to visit, for me to visit San Francisco again and to appear here and through this broadcast. Before I respond to your question, I would like to say that I'm very grateful for your overly generous introduction. It's always pleasant to have nice things said about you, particularly in front of a group of strangers. But there is a risk, of course, that if you hear it too often, you might begin to believe some of that stuff. So I like to begin with a story about introductions and how I was on one occasion brought back down to earth. I spent 5 years working on the peace process in Northern Ireland. I chaired three separate sets of discussion over that period. When it was completed, I returned to my home in Maine and wrote a book about that experience. And then, as now, I went on a book tour around the country, and I received many invitations. In the process, I learned the interesting fact that in the United States, there are more Irish American organizations than there are Irish Americans. And every one of them wrote to me and asked me to please come and visit their town and their club. I went to many. I couldn't go to them all. But as I traveled the country, speaking to these Irish American groups, there developed among them an informal competition as to who could give the longest, most fantastic, sometimes truly ridiculous introductions of me. The proper reaction, of course, would have been for me to show some humility, to ask them to please keep it short, but I had an improper reaction. I loved it. I encouraged them. I scolded them when they left something out. They got longer and longer, 20 minutes in the introduction, 25 minutes in the introduction. So by the time I got to the very last stop on this tour, it was the Stamford, Connecticut Irish American Society. I was overly impressed with myself, had a hard time squeezing my head through the front door. When I got in, the first person I met was an elderly woman who rushed up to me, very excited and nervous, shook my hand vigorously, spent several minutes telling me about all the great things I'd done. And then she said, I don't live anywhere near here. I drove 3.5 hours across the entire state of Connecticut to come here just to meet you and ask you, please, would you autograph my poster? She handed me a poster with a big photograph and a pen. I looked at it. I said, I'll be very happy to sign you a poster. But before I do, I think I should tell you that I'm not Henry Kissinger. She said, you're not. Well, who are you anyway? And when I told her, she said, well, that's just terrible. She said, I drove 3.5 hours to meet a great man like Kissinger, and all I've got is a nobody like you. I said, I'm sorry you feel so bad. I wish there's something I could do to make you feel better. And after a few seconds, she said, well, there is. And when I asked what it was, she leaned forward. I leaned forward in a kind of a conspiratorial mode, and she whispered, nobody will ever know the difference. She said, would you mind signing Henry Kissinger's name to my poster? So I did. And it's hanging today in her living room wall in Eastern Connecticut, a daily reminder to me to enjoy the kind words, like being compared to lobsters, but don't take them too seriously.
Yeah.
Well, let me now be serious and say in response to your question, Mr. Ambassador. Alone and I both spent many years working in the Middle East. As envoy for President Obama, it was my second tour of duty there. I'd previously served at the request of President Clinton and Middle Eastern leaders as chairman of an international commission on violence in the region. Alone had been there, spent years there working in the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv and the U.S. Consulate in Jerusalem. I met him when I was appointed and I recruited for my staff as envoy a group of people who were experts in particular fields, and Alone was among them. We believe that there is no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created, conducted, sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings. As we say in the book, we acknowledge the many failed efforts in the region. We acknowledge the difficulties that confront anyone trying to bring peace to that specific conflict and to the deeply troubled wider region. But we also believe that it is very much in the interests, first of the United States and of the people of Israel and the Palestinians and others in the region, that Israelis and Palestinians reach an agreement under which each achieves its primary objective. Israel has a state, a very successful state, but its people live in constant fear and anxiety. They don't have security on a day-to-day basis, and they ought to have it, reasonable and sustainable security. The Palestinians don't have a state, and they want one, and they ought to have one, an independent, sovereign, non-militarized state, living side by side in peace with Israelis. In 2008, in the year before he left office, President George W. Bush traveled to Jerusalem, and there he met with a large group of Israeli and Palestinian leaders. He was pursuing the objective of peace through a plan which he had announced years earlier, which he called the Roadmap for Peace. And he made the argument to both groups that they should be interested in the other's success as well as theirs, because it is the only way that they can achieve what they want. Stated another way, President Bush argued that for Israelis to achieve security, there has to be a Palestinian state, and for the Palestinians, they're never going to get a state until the people of Israel have reasonable and sustainable security. We quote President Bush's speech at length in our book, and we believe it to be a concise and persuasive statement of American policy and of the best, and in our assessment, the only reasonably likely to be successful course in the region. The two-state solution, as it is commonly referred to, has not been successful yet, despite the efforts of 12 American presidents and 20 secretaries of state. President-elect Trump will be the 13th president, and whoever he appoints secretary of state will be the 21st. But in the pursuit of peace, one failure or many failures cannot be taken as the final word. When I was in Northern Ireland, I was asked almost every day, over a period of years, by members of the media, "Senator, you've failed to get a peace agreement. When are you going home?" And of course, they were right. When your objective is a peace agreement, until you get it, you have failed. But as I've said many times, we had 700 days of failure in the principal negotiation and one day of success. Although the conflict had extended back 800 years, although there had been many failed efforts, we were able finally to achieve it thanks to the courage of the political leaders of Northern Ireland, the people of Northern Ireland, and the leaders of the British and Irish governments. So we're well aware of the skepticism, the cynicism, the deep hostility, and the differences between the two parties in the Middle East. We're also well aware that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict cannot be viewed or solved in isolation from the region in which it is located. A region now going through incredible turmoil, widespread violence and upheaval that influences Israeli-Palestinian relations and are in turn influenced by that relationship. But we also believe that societies and nations, like individuals, ultimately act out of self-interest. And while it may take both individuals and societies some time to accurately perceive their self-interest, we believe that Israelis and Palestinians will ultimately come to see that it is in their mutual self-interest to reach an agreement. When President Carter convened a meeting at Camp David in 1979 between Prime Minister Begin and President Sadat of Egypt, the relationship between those two powers had been far more difficult and destructive than as the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians. There were major wars fought, many casualties, much destruction. Many people thought it wasn't possible, but a peace agreement was reached between Israel and Egypt, and it has stood to this day a pillar of stability, between those two countries and of Israel's foreign policy. In 1994, President Clinton brokered a peace agreement between Israel and Jordan, and that agreement has stood. Also a contributor to some degree of stability and a pillar of Israel's policy to this day. We believe that similarly, the time will come, and we hope and pray that it is sooner, before there is another destructive round of violence, that the two sides agree. We know that support for the two-state solution is declining in the United States, in Israel, and among Palestinians. That is understandable. Frustration, even despair, leads people to believe that there must be some other magical solution, as yet undiscovered, that if someone can just think it up and express it, it'll bring the two sides together. We don't think it exists. We don't think it will come into being. We think that the only way this issue can be resolved is for the two sides to sit down in direct negotiations, aided and supported by the United States, the only entity in the world that has the capacity to create the conditions within which peace can be achieved between Israelis and Palestinians, and of equal importance, to assure its implementation. And so we wanted to make a contribution to defending the two-state solution, to explaining why, in detail, we believe the alternatives that have been presented so far and discussed are far less likely to be successful, and hopefully to generate debate and discussion in our own country and action by President Obama before he leaves office and making a statement on the subject, and for the newly elected president to try to renew the initiatives that have begun before. We completed the book before the presidential election. We did not know who would be elected when we wrote these words. We'll see what plans the new administration has, but we think, finally, and repeating, it is very much in the interest of our country that we pursue the effort and that we seek to bring about peace between Israelis and Palestinians and stability throughout that region to the extent that we can do so.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Senator Mitchell, or Dr. Kissinger. But I think I draw comfort from what you're saying, which is that it is inevitable. All conflicts end eventually among interdependent people. They can't eliminate each other. They can't avoid each other. And so at some point, they have to find a way to live together. But as you said, when you wrote the book, you didn't know who would be the next president. The conventional wisdom was that more likely it would be Secretary Clinton. And now, with this new political environment, I have to think, is this the time and are these the people who can bring it to pass? First question is, there appears to be a very close relationship or a close affinity between President-elect Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. Do you think that plays in a positive way or in a negative way? Or how does it play in terms of accomplishing a peace?
We begin our book describing an incident of a bitter exchange between an American president and a prime minister in which the president proposed a peace plan that the prime minister felt was a betrayal of Israel, in which he denounced in very sharp and harsh terms. It turns out, we don't want to give away the secrets at the beginning, but many people reading it assume it's Obama and Netanyahu. But in fact, it's a description of what happened when President Reagan proposed his peace plan in 1982 and Prime Minister Menachem Begin in the strongest and most intensely personal terms, rejected it and repudiated it, and the plan went nowhere. We described the extraordinarily tense and difficult relationship between President Eisenhower and Prime Minister Ben-Gurion when Israel joined with Britain and France to take control of the Suez Canal. President Eisenhower refused to even talk with Prime Minister Begin until after Israel withdrew, threatened to go to the United Nations and achieve a Security Council resolution critical of Israel. Netanyahu and Clinton didn't get along, famously. The point we make is that the United States and Israel are vibrant democracies. We have an exceedingly close relationship, but they are not always identical. And differences between our two countries, differences between our two leaders, are inevitable, have occurred, will occur, but they do not affect adversely the underlying relationship, which is strong between two people and two countries. And not to be critical of the media, there's been plenty of criticism of them, controversy makes news. So to the extent that there is difference between the president and the prime minister, it's played up and dramatized and constantly leads many people to believe that it dominates the relationship rather than the reverse. So we don't know what's going to happen in the new administration. I make no predictions about it. We are heartened by the fact that the president-elect has said on several occasions he wants to try to reach an agreement. He has said he thinks it's important. He said in one statement that many people tell him it's impossible, but he's going to try anyway because he thinks there's a good deal can be made there. And my reaction is, let's hope and pray he succeeds. We have no indication of what policy he may adopt, how he may pursue that, we accept that it's up to him, and we hope he devotes attention, activity, and that he is able to produce a good result.
Now, one of the great insights from your book, which I strongly recommend, is in the beginning when you go through all these relationships between American presidents and Israeli prime ministers, and notwithstanding the fact that, you know, we always talk about how the commitment of the U.S. to Israel's security is ironclad and the close relationship between the countries, every single one of them has had the ultimate low point in American-Israel relations. You know, and everyone forgets the last low point that we had, but in each case they had this tension. The question now, though, is that there has been a movement away from the Clinton principles the last 15 years that have been sort of the consistent talking point and basis. Now people are talking about, you know, should there be a one-state solution?
Right.
And what are your thoughts about where that goes and whether there's a path forward there, and if not, why?
Yeah. I'm going to let Alon address that because he basically wrote the chapter analyzing the one-state solution. It's a full chapter in our book, a very detailed analysis of it, and I'll let Alon answer, and then I'll comment after his answer.
Sure. We write in the book, after looking at the one-state solution, if you could call it a solution, that partition is inevitable because of all the reasons that led the UN to partition the land in the first place in 1947, which is that Israeli and Palestinian national, economic, and political priorities are just totally incompatible and different, and that trying to resolve those within one entity would lead to intercommunal violence and just a ton of death and destruction. And because of that, we believe there eventually will be partition. The question isn't if, but it's when, how, and on what terms. And today, a lot of Israelis, more conservative Israelis, they look at the situation in the West Bank and they believe that that can continue indefinitely. And they are reassured by the fact that the West Bank today is calm and stable, especially compared to the region that they're in. And the situation of their neighbors, take Syria, for example, not far away. But the reason, one of the reasons that the West Bank is so stable today is because of the really close security cooperation between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government and the Israeli military. Despite all of the difficulties between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas, that security relationship has actually matured over the years and is still quite deep. but it's losing popularity on the Palestinian street rapidly. Many Palestinians are now seeing their own leadership in the Palestinian Authority not as the people who will bring them independence, but as a body that is easing the burden of occupation on Israel, that is doing Israel's business in the West Bank. That is a very dangerous situation to be in, because if the Palestinian Authority, if future Palestinian Authority leaders end that security cooperation, the Israelis will be forced to reoccupy parts of the West Bank, or the security situation is going to devolve seriously. And so that brings us back to the situation of violence and destruction that will eventually lead back to partition, but on much worse terms than there could be today. And one of the arguments that we draw out in the book is Senator Mitchell mentioned the Reagan peace plan in the 1980s. That plan was fundamentally anti-statehood for Palestinians. President Reagan said it when he announced his plan, that he does not support the creation of a Palestinian state, but self-autonomy for Palestinians in enclaves of the West Bank under Jordanian sovereignty. Fast forward to today, Menachem Begin could not have dreamed that the way we talk about the conflict now would ever come about, that two states, the entire world is talking about it. And in fact, the plan that he rejected in the 80s is the dream of the Israeli right today. So the argument that we're making is this march towards the one-state scenario, I'm not going to call it a solution because it's a recipe for disaster, but the march towards the one-state solution is in fact making the deal worse from the Israeli perspective. They concede more for getting less, and it's closing options for how to resolve this conflict in the future.
If I could add a comment to it, it's clear that the two-state solution is losing support in both societies. Alone addressed Israeli society, let me comment on Palestinian society. They're divided. The Palestinian Authority, led by President Abbas, has for a quarter of a century outspokenly recognized Israel, accepts prior agreements, and opposes the use of violence to gain Palestinian statehood. Their opponents are Hamas, which now controls Gaza, who reject each of the principles that I've just described. And the most important distinction is Hamas insists on the right to use force to end the occupation. So there's a debate going on within Palestinian Authority for which side the two will take. And it's clearly moving away from peaceful negotiation and recognition of Israel and toward the use of violence. And it's there have been several turning points. I'll describe one that occurred when Alon and I were there. Anyone who follows the events in the region, as I'm sure many or most of you do, will recall that Hamas engaged in a military incursion in which some Israeli soldiers were captured. One of them, Corporal Gilad Shalit, survived and was held prisoner by the Palestinians for several years. It was a very emotional issue within Israel, as it really would be in any country where you have one of your military personnel held captive by their opponents. And so the Israelis negotiated with Hamas through intermediaries for several years. And then they finally made an agreement under which Corporal Shalit was released to Israel in exchange for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners then held in Israeli prisons. I begged Prime Minister Netanyahu to release some prisoners to President Abbas and the Palestinian Authority at the same time, because the argument I made, which I believe is plainly true, is that the message it sent was Violence pays. Message to the Palestinians, message to all Arabs, message to all Muslims. Violence pays. Peaceful non-negotiation does not. And that's what's happening now in Palestinian society. So the question is, can there be an agreement before there is another outbreak of violence of some sort that, without a doubt, Israel will prevail in because of the overwhelming military dominance that it has, but which will be costly in terms of lives and property, in terms of Israel's standing in the world? Although Israel is in a very strong position in the United States, its position around the world is declining. As we point out in the book, 160 countries now recognize Israel, 137 recognize Palestine, and many parliaments in Western democracies have passed resolutions and other forms of statements expressing support for a Palestinian state. We believe there should be a state, but we don't believe it will be achieved other than nominally through these declarations. It has to be negotiations between the parties in which Israel is involved, and they can reach agreement in a way that is can be implemented and is sustainable.
You've both spoken, Senator Mitchell and Alon Sarkar, about the complexity of the relationship, the history, what has been tried, what's failed, what the internal politics are, and the current administration or the incoming administration has been priding itself so far in terms of shaking things up at the State Department, not necessarily reaching out, speaking to protocol officers before taking calls from foreign leaders, and in general suggesting that, you know, maybe bringing in some outsiders without much experience will dislodge challenges that have been persistent. So one of the questions is based on your experience in Northern Ireland. Does it help to bring in people who really don't have a lot of experience or depth in the issues and just sort of come at it as sort of a clean slate? Or is it essential when you were negotiating that agreement to have greater depth, to be able to validate the experiences of both sides in order for them to listen to you in a peace process?
First, I don't think it's either or. I think each situation is unique and specific and requires a unique and specific solution. Secondly, knowledge can be acquired, even though it doesn't exist. It depends upon the person. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a lot of experience in Northern Ireland before I went there, but I spent a couple of years reading several dozen books, educating myself, meeting with all of the leaders in the region, and I acquired some insights into what their views were. I was also told about it by them on the first day that we convened the negotiations. After a long, bitter effort just to get to negotiations, a delegate stood up and said in a loud voice to me, "Senator Mitchell, if you are to help us, there's one thing about the people of Northern Ireland you must understand." And I said, "What is it?" He said, "We would drive 100 miles out of our way to receive an insult." And like you, I laughed, and then I realized I was the only person in the room laughing.
Yeah.
They all had chips on their shoulders. That's what he was telling me, and they're big chips. And the same thing exists in the region. So you have to have insight. But in the end, I think it's judgment that matters. As in most human affairs, a degree of knowledge that enables you to address the issues and a degree of judgment that enables you primarily to defer to the people involved in the conflict. I also told them on my first day in Northern Ireland that I did not come with an American peace plan. I said, there is no Clinton plan. There is no Mitchell plan. If there ever is an agreement, it will be your agreement because this is your country. When this is over, I'm going home and you have to live here. And when I drafted the peace plan years later, I was careful to include only words that had been spoken or written by someone from Northern Ireland. And I pointed that out to them in a memorandum which I attached to the final draft that I distributed to the parties for approval on the last day. I think that's critically important everywhere. It's the people of Israel and the Palestinian people who are going to live with the consequences of any agreement, not the Americans who participate in the discussions. But the reality is they're not able to sit down and talk and reach an agreement on their own. For one thing, no one can assure implementation of an agreement other than the United States. That's the clear lesson of the agreements with Egypt and Jordan. What is, most Americans look upon the Israeli-Egyptian agreement with pride, and rightly so. But what is the glue that holds that agreement together? It's $5 billion a year paid by American taxpayers, $3 billion to Israel, $2 billion to Egypt. And that was 37 years ago, so that's $185 billion and still going. No one in the world can assure implementation of an Israeli-Palestinian agreement other than the United States, although in this case, it is my judgment that we will have to get help from a lot of others around the world, Arab countries in the region, Western Europeans, and let me say, they do provide considerable assistance to this day to the Palestinians who are in desperate economic condition, and to Israel as well in some cases. But no one can do it but the United States. And it is imperative, therefore, that we take an active role in not only bringing them to negotiations, but within the negotiations themselves.
Senator Mitchell, I have to say, I've been doing these programs for a little while, and you have elicited the thickest stack of questions that we have ever had at one of these programs. So clearly a lot of interest in what you have to say. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guests are Senator George Mitchell, retired U.S. Senator and former U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, and Alon Sakar, former advisor to the U.S. Ambassador to Israel, as well as an advisor to Senator Mitchell. And both are authors of a new book discussing the best way forward for Middle East peace. I'm Ambassador Jeff Bleich, former special counsel to President Obama and chair of Denton's Diplomatic Solutions, and I'm your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel, as well as Facebook and Twitter and commonwealthclub.org. So you talked about how, in addition to the U.S. being an essential party, other nations have to be engaged as well, including, you mentioned, Arab nations, European nations. What role in particular should Lebanon and Jordan play in ensuring a two-state solution?
Well, Jordan already plays an important role in the region. It's a very important American ally. It has signed an agreement with Israel, which has stabilized the border between the two countries, and they have an ongoing cooperative relationship that has proven to be very effective. I think that I know from our experience that King Abdullah is very supportive of the effort that the United States is making. On several crucial occasions, stepped in and stepped up to provide assistance while we were there, as his father had done before, and as I expect he will continue. Lebanon itself confronts very serious and difficult problems, as you know. There is a division within Lebanon. They just recently were able to elect a president after a two-year vacancy in the presidency based upon what we would call gridlock or dysfunctional politics. They have a new president and will shortly have a new prime minister, but they are currently overwhelmed by the refugee crisis from Syria. Lebanon has a population of 4 million people, and they have approximately 1,300,000 Syrian refugees in Lebanon. That's equal to a third of the population. Per capita basis, it would be as though the United States had 110 million refugees coming into the country. It's obviously a practical impossibility for them to deal with it. So I think for now, they're primarily concerned with dealing with the effects of the Syrian crisis. It's an internal dynamic within Israel because Hezbollah, supported by Iran, has provided not just moral support but military support in the form of fighters who are joined with President Assad in the fight that's going on in Syria. And that's a very controversial issue within Lebanon itself.
Several of the audience members would actually like your advice for the incoming president on some of these issues, including Syria.
Including
Syria. So one of the questions, and this could be for Alon as well, is that for supporters of Israel, the president seems to be wanting it both ways, voicing unprecedented backing of Israel, but at the same time favoring Russia, which courts Iran and Syria and enemies of Israel. So how does that play out, that you can reach out and support Russia and support Russian ambitions in the region, and yet at the same time reassure Israel that you have their best interests at heart?
Go ahead, Alon.
I'll make a comment after. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, the nature of international relationships, and particularly American relationships in the region, are incredibly complicated. We have... We support a lot of parties that themselves fight one another. For example, the Kurds in Iraq and the Turkish government. We work with both. Turkey is an ally of ours. We work with the Kurds in Iraq, but they fight one another. So
India, Pakistan.
India, Pakistan. I mean, it's endless, really, in the Middle East. The number of relationships just that the United States has, in which our partners fight one another. So that's not necessarily a new development. Even throughout the U.S.-Israel relationship, we've had great relations with the Israelis, but we've also had really close relationships with the Jordanians and the Egyptians and other Arabs, sometimes even before they had peace with one another. So I don't think that's anything new going forward. One thing we do recommend in the book is that specifically on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and achieving an end to that, that the next administration not rush into negotiations unless they are themselves convinced that the parties actually want a peace agreement and are talking the same or speaking the same words when they talk of peace. Both today say they want a two-state solution but have very different meanings of what a two-state solution means. And so that's one piece of advice that we give the future American president when dealing with the region, is to just ensure that the parties are somewhere within the same ballpark, because we can't force them into an agreement that they don't want. That hasn't worked ever in the past. We go through the history of relations between U.S. presidents and Israeli prime ministers, and the fact of the matter is that while we're there to support a peace agreement and we can create the conditions for a peace agreement and we could fortify any agreements, they themselves have to first agree that that's what they want to do. We wouldn't have had the the Israel-Egypt peace agreement without that. And even the Oslo Accords, the U.S. wasn't even involved in the Oslo Accords, which was the first of a number of major agreements between the Israelis and the Palestinians, the first time they ever recognized one another. That was basically a done deal when we got involved, but we were there because it was important for us to reinforce it and to legitimize it like only the United States can do.
Let me comment specifically on Syria, which is a part of your question. First, I think we have to place it in the context of history. there are many lessons of history, one of which is that the removal of oppressive governments by revolution does not guarantee its replacement with a better government. The most obvious example is Russia under the Tsars for several centuries. They were removed in a violent revolution, and they got Stalin and the communists. We see it now playing out in many parts of the Middle East. Gaddafi was a brutal dictator and ruler. He's been removed, and violence has occurred. We saw it in the former Yugoslavia, pulled together under the state dominated by Tito, and upon his death it disintegrated and the old historical animosities rose again. So there aren't neat and easy solutions to every problem. And that surely is the case in Syria. I do not favor the continuation of the Assad regime. As brutal as some of the Islamic extremists have been, like ISIS, the notion that a government drops barrel bombs on the schools of its own children, on its hospitals, on residential areas of its cities, is to me an atrocity that disqualifies that government from continuing. But given the deeply pent-up hostilities after several decades of oppressive rule by a minority, it's not possible to say that any one solution would have worked or would have been better. I served in President Obama's administration. I support him, but I believe one of the huge negatives of his legacy will be Syria, how it has been handled, what the consequences have been, even though no one can honestly and fairly say if he'd done A, B, or C, it would have had a better result. Nonetheless, the drawing of the line in the sand was a mistake. The not responding when the line was crossed was a mistake. And we have further contributed by this constant so-called negotiation with the Russians while Syrians are dying by the hundreds and the thousands. Now, Russia's interest is different from ours. Russia has, for over a half century, had a large naval base in Syria. There are thousands of Russian men, military, security, others, who've come to Syria over that period, married Syrian women, lived there. It's their outlet to the Mediterranean, and they value it highly. It doesn't have the same status in our hierarchies of importance in terms of foreign policy, but it is an incredible humanitarian disaster. And look, you have to look back on time. We shouldn't be too condescending about the Arabs being unable to resolve their differences. What's happening now occurred in Western society in previous centuries. In France, from the revolution, it took 60 years before they established a modern form of government. In England, depending on how you count, 100 or more years, violent internal conflict. The difference now, of course, is that the populations are larger, the methods of destruction are much more effective, and so the numbers of people killed and maimed and affected and driven out to become pariahs on the world stage as they seek safety elsewhere are very much larger than they were even in the past century. The fact is, this is a digression, but people say we live in such a dangerous world. In fact, the world is now, on a per capita basis, less dangerous than ever. You and every other American worried about terrorism, there's more chance that you'll be killed by a lightning strike than by a terrorist if you live in the United States. Reality is that more than 90% of people killed by terrorism in the world today are Muslims living in Muslim countries, killed by other Muslims. In the 20th century, approximately 125 million people died in a world in which the population was a third of what it is now, died in violent conflicts. In just the First and Second World Wars, 78 million people died. So while people die now in dozens and hundreds, they died then in the thousands, and on some horrific days, tens of thousands. But perception is reality. People believe it, and so we have to act upon it. My own view is that we should have done a lot more in Syria, and we have to do more now. Not sending American troops in, but engaging in more activity to counterbalance what the Russians are doing. And this long, long period in which our officials meet with their officials and we urge them to do something for peace while they're bombing civilians, while they're destroying communities and societies, and we're talking with them, trying to persuade them to join with us in an effort. I think it's one of the, it's a failure of the current administration, and I hope it's soon corrected.
Now, your book is written for future administrations, but not just the U.S., U.S., Israel, Palestinian. And is there concern that because you don't have a Palestinian on the book cover, on the book cover is one of your co-authors.
Oh, yeah.
That this is that this really reflects a Western Judeo-Christian, ultimately pro-Israel point of view and perspective.
Yeah, it's a commonplace argument. I've traveled to every Arab country and to most Muslim countries, and their view is that the United States is 100% pro-Israel and really doesn't care about the Palestinians. And my argument to them is, first, that's not true. And secondly, even if it were, they should be involved in trying to come up with a resolution to the problem. I believe that the position, as expressed by President Bush, to which I earlier referred, puts the United States in the position of supporting the objectives of both sides. And in fact, to those who argue that we haven't supported the Palestinians, the United States is the principal financial supporter of the Palestinian people who live in incredibly difficult circumstances. On a per capita basis, it's not too far behind the billions that we provide to Israel. And when I was the envoy, I traveled to all of the Arab countries for the specific purpose of urging them to provide funding for Palestinians to be able to eat and have housing. In fact, one time when I got back to Ramallah, one of the highest-ranking Palestinian officials said to me, why is it that an American has to go around to other Arab countries to get them to support us? And I said, that's a good question. Mm. I said, you ought to ask that of them. So I think we are able to serve as an honest broker, even though we are unshakably committed to Israel's security, because we believe that Israel has a right to exist with reasonable and sustainable security behind defensible borders. And the way to achieve that, in part, is through the creation of a Palestinian state. And that will enable Israel to establish normalized relations with its Arab neighbors because they share much in common. Right now, a principal, some would argue, the principal foreign policy objective of Israel is to deter the Iranian drive for hegemony in the region. Well, that is the absolutely identical objective of Saudi Arabia. So you have two countries in the region with the same goal, and they're not cooperating. There may be some private discussions, but they should be overtly allied. And it makes sense for Israel to establish normalized relations with its Arab neighbor. That was one of the goals that we had while we were there. If you look at the demographics, do I have a minute just to discuss the demographics? Because they are critical. Right now, there are about 6.25 million Jews in the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. There's an approximately equal number of Arabs, if you count Israeli Arabs, Palestinians on the West Bank and Gaza. The birth rates overall are such that no later than 2020 and perhaps before, there will be a clear majority of Arabs. And Prime Minister Barak has said many times, former Prime Minister Barak, getting back to the point that Alone made earlier, that if the two-state solution is lost, the people of Israel will face a choice they should not have to face, and that's between continuing to be a Jewish state or a democratic state. And when you look at the demographics region-wide, it's even more daunting. It took 1,800 years following the birth of Christ for the world's population to reach 1 billion. The most recent billion, the seventh, was added in 13 years. And although the rate of increase has slowed, the absolute numbers are still growing. Of the 7.5 billion people in the world today, 1 in 5 is Muslim, just over 1.5 billion. When the world's population reaches near 10 billion, just after the middle of this century, 1 in 3 will be Muslim. 3.5 billion, that was the total population of the world as recently as 1970. It is in Israel's interest to establish normalized relations with its neighbors and not to be in a constant state of conflict in a circumstance where the demographics are becoming overwhelming in the manner that I've described. Now, I want to be clear about one thing. I recognize there are Islamic extremists who use religion as a weapon in their violent conflict, not just against us, but against, as I said, mostly other Muslims. But I believe, having visited all the Arab countries and many Muslim countries, including the largest Muslim country in the world, Indonesia, which is today a vibrant democracy, that the vast majority of Muslims in the world want what people everywhere want, a decent home, a decent job, and most importantly of all, for everyone here who's a parent will understand, the desire to get their children off to a good start in life. But the way they're going to get it is by standing up themselves and speaking out and fighting against and eliminating these radicals, not just leaving it to the United States to do. We can help, we can support. But just as the people of America decide the future of America, so should the people of countries in other parts of the world decide their own futures. And it's up to them to make the case and to fight the fight that's necessary to achieve the kind of society that will benefit all of their people.
The audience has a number of tactical questions about how you get there. And so to make sure we get to as many as we can, I'm going to give you sort of three together.
Okay.
One asks a bit about what President-elect Trump has suggested, which is a plan to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. And in your perspective, would that be helpful or harmful to advancing the peace process that you've described? The second is, when you say end the occupation, what do you mean? Is it having Israel leave the West Bank, or is it having an Israeli state in any part of the area that's currently considered now the occupation? And then the third tactic was, what do you think of this notion of liberation preceding integration?
What?
Liberation precedes integration.
Okay. You go ahead now. Respond. I got
thank you, Alone.
I got an answer each of those.
Yeah,
go ahead.
The first one was about moving the embassy to Jerusalem.
Yeah, Jerusalem.
You know, for decades now, presidents on the campaign trail have made similar promises, and the embassy is still in Tel Aviv. It would be very, very difficult in terms of U.S. relations with the Arab world and the Muslim world if we were to move our embassy to Jerusalem, mainly because it's not just about a nationalist conflict in Jerusalem. It is a religious, and there is a religious component there that affects people around the world. And there are a lot of Arab countries that have a stake also in the future outcome of Jerusalem. So, you know, it's not an insurmountable challenge if it happens. But I think the conflicts that might arise are very real. And I think it would be very difficult for a president to do that. Every president, Republican or Democrat, going back maybe 3 decades now, has chosen not to do that, affirmatively chosen not to do that. they sign a waiver every year to not do that because Congress has actually passed a resolution to move the embassy to Jerusalem. The second question is about the how do you end the Israeli occupation or what that looks like? Well, in negotiations going back all the way to Camp David in 2000 and in subsequent negotiations since, there has always been a consideration for how you can draw the borders in such a way that includes the maximum number of Israeli settlers on Israel's side of the border without breaking apart the contiguity of a Palestinian state or taking up too much of the territory in the West Bank and compensating the Palestinians for that land on some kind of territorial swap. So that is a way, that has been the way the issue of territory has been discussed in the past, and I think that's the only way moving forward. There, it is just a fact that today in the West Bank, there are 400,000 Israeli settlers. And if you count Israelis that live in parts of Jerusalem that were not Israel prior to 1967, that number is closer to 600,000. And it's just not feasible to relocate that number of people. But if you can redraw the borders in such a way that includes the maximum number of people on Israel's side of the border, then the amount of relocation that needs to take place is much, much lower, and it makes implementation much more feasible. And the third question?
Liberation before integration.
Well, let's focus on liberation first. Does that mean integration of the two societies?
I'm just reading the question.
Yeah. I think we need to focus on getting to the two-state solution first. I think that needs to be, both Israelis and Palestinians need that going forward. It is a lose-lose proposition that this conflict continue. So before we can look at what might happen after there is a two-state solution and it's implemented, I think we really need to focus and keep fighting for the two-state solution.
On Jerusalem, I believe that it would be a setback to the process and reduce the likelihood of resolving the conflict if the president-elect moves the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. However, if it is done, I hope very much that it will be accompanied by an acknowledgement that recognizes the possibility of there being a Palestinian capital in some part of Jerusalem in the future. If it is done in a manner that wholly forecloses that option, then I think it will be a very serious negative blow toward any effort to resolve the conflict. And as Alon said, it's important to understand the Palestinians have a free hand in negotiating with Israel on every issue other than Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a Muslim issue. It's not just a Palestinian issue. And an action that effectively precluded there ever being the possibility of a Palestinian state, even in the Palestinian areas of Jerusalem, would be a very serious, perhaps fatal blow to any effort to bring about a two-state solution.
Well, we are down to our final 2 minutes, and you have done an amazing job answering a lot of the questions that were in the audience's submissions, and the ones that you didn't answer are all ones that would require about 7 days of discussion. So in the final 2 minutes, this one's a little bit off topic, but you've devoted your life to arbitrating disputes effectively as a judge. As Speaker of the House, you were known for bringing both sides together and fostering a spirit of bipartisanship, and then obviously your work in the in Northern Ireland and now in Israel and Palestinian territory. What is your advice for the next president in terms of how you actually bring the country together, the Congress together, and these conflict areas together? What qualities should he be striving for in the next 4 years?
Yeah. I've actually answered that question rather thoroughly before. On October 25th, about 2 weeks before the election, Georgetown University invited me and two other persons, one a Republican and one an independent, I a Democrat, to give a speech entitled Advice to the Next President. So I gave a speech on that. I'd be very happy to give it here today, although I don't think time permits it. But if anybody here would like one, just get in touch with the Commonwealth Club, and I'll see that they get a copy of it. I can't repeat all of it now. I don't know. How much time do we have? Are we out of time?
We are out of time. We're in our final 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, then that's my answer. Write to me and you'll get a full copy of my comments. I spent 15 years in the Senate, six as Senate Majority Leader, so I've acquired the dubious ability to be able to speak at indefinite length on any subject, often with no prior knowledge, usually neither conveying any knowledge or information, but I can fill any time gap, and what you're telling me is that I've already done so.
So thank you for coming to the Commonwealth Club, where we refer you to speeches from the Georgetown University.
Right.
Our thanks to Senator George Mitchell, retired United States Senator, former U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, and Alon Sakar, former advisor to the U.S. Ambassador to Israel, as well as to Senator Mitchell. Both gentlemen are co-authors of an outstanding book that I commend to you, A Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations, and A Way Forward in the Middle East. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. A reminder to everyone here that our speaker's book is for sale, and they'll be signing copies right after the program. I'm Ambassador Jeff Blanche, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.